You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with
Russ Denman, production editor,
and
Susie Evans, senior editor.
And we're going to talk about, first, about the Humana Festival of New American Plays at Actors Theatre Louisville. Both Russ and Susie went to that recently. Then we're going to talk, I'll talk briefly about the Ground on Which I Stand, the famous August Wilson speech, which is going to celebrate its 20th anniversary soon. And there was a commemorative event at Princeton at the MacArthur where it first happened. I went to that on Monday and I'm going to write about it for the website. And we're planning much more coverage of it actually in coming issues. And then we have an interview with Louis Douthat, who is the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Tell me.
She is the interim director of literary development and dramaturgy, as well as director of Play On, which is their commissioning program of contemporary modern English adaptations, translations, as they call it, of Shakespeare.
Into contemporary modern English.
That's right.
Right. Controversial project, and we'll find out all about it. Yep. Interview with her. But let's start with Louisville and Humana. These plays have just ended. We're going to be writing a big piece about the first play on the program, which was Sarah Rules for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday. Could you tell me a little bit about that play and about the festival, Susie?
Yeah, totally. So that was the festival was on its 40th anniversary this year, and the big headlining play was Sarah Rules for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday, starring Kathleen Chalfant as Peter Pan, sort of. Peter Pan, yeah, and directed by the theater's artistic director, Les Waters. It was a lot different than I expected. We have a writer in Louisville writing this big piece for our production notebook section for our July-August issue about kind of the process of putting this up. And, you know, I thought initially that it was going to be a lot of flying and a lot of, you know, Peter Pan and all that stuff. It's actually, it reminded me a lot of a Richard Nelson play. It's very quiet. It's three acts. There's like three very separate, distinct parts with interesting transitions. It opens with Kathleen Chalfant, just as her character. I forget what her character's name was.
Anne,
A woman with four siblings, one sister and three brothers, all in older years, 50s and 60s, just talking about her memories of childhood Peter Pan. And then the first part is in the hospital room. Her father's dying. The second part is after her father has died, just sitting around a table with her siblings talking about politics, just the way you would assume a family. It really reminded me of an Apple Family play.
Right.
And then the third act is it's a fantasy that all of these adult siblings are in Peter Pan. And so Kathleen Chalfant is Peter Pan. Her sister, played by Lisa Emery, is Wendy. Two of her brothers are Michael and John. And one of her other brothers is Captain Hook. And they just, you know, they talk about aging and they talk about all these crazy things as these Peter Pan characters, like dressed as you would expect them to be.
Wow.
And one of the coolest things is there's this Louisville-based flying and rigging company called ZFX that did all of the flying for the production. So that Lisa Emery and Kathleen Chalfant actually both fly in the last act. And they actually, ZFX has actually worked with Humana before. They did The Apprentice plays, I think it was in 2013.
Okay.
Lucas Naith wrote one of them called Night Night. It's still one of my favorite Lucas Naith plays I've ever seen. It's a short play about astronauts where all the actors were suspended from the air for the
awesome.
Whole play. Yeah, and it was really cool. I mean, it was very different than I expected, though. I thought
Me
it was
going
to be this big design production, and it was very intimate. I don't know. What do you think, Russ?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. I thought there would be much more emphasis on the Peter Pan component of the play. And as Susie is describing, that was really a kind of internal exploration of their everyday lives through the medium of this Peter Pan world. And theatricality is a really big component of the play. So the wires are very visible. We have the direct address at the beginning of the piece with Kathleen Chalfant just coming out and talking about her character's life as an actor. And it was particularly striking for me, at least with the audience who was there at my performance, that there was a sense in the room that this was Kathleen Chalfant talking about her own story. It wasn't, of course. It's actually inspired by
Sarah's mother,
who did play Peter Pan when she was young, right? I mean, when Sarah was young, her mother played
Peter
Pan.
In this play, Kathleen Chalfant's character played Peter Pan when she was young, and it's the nostalgic looking back.
That's right. And so there was this moment, this hush over the crowd where it seemed as though Kathleen Chalfant was just standing there and talking about her life. Her life as mm-hmm. as an actor. And I knew that wasn't the case, but there was definitely that sense in the room. And so that was pretty fascinating.
It's a tribute to her her acting.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
it was a really special play. It's going to Berkeley Rep next. Right. So
just a matter of time before we see it in New York, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally.
Susie, I think this was part of the production, not just the performance I attended, but the marching band?
Oh, yeah. The marching band was really cool.
Yeah.
It was kind of – they had a different like community marching band because like there were through these three separate parts and there were transitions between the parts. Mm-hmm. And between the first part in the hospital and the second part at the dinner table, a marching band comes in and plays As the Saints Go Marching In, which is kind of in the play a lot. It's kind of thematically. Yeah. And so, yeah, there was marching band. It was really cool. They just came in and played it while they switched the set.
Wow. So it's like one of those Lyre de Bessinet public things.
Where or like when Alex Timbers had a marching band in Love's Labor's Lost.
Yeah, I thought about that.
It felt very much like that. And it's similar because when Les did the Christians at Humana, they had a community choir who did the choir all the time. So they had a community marching band. It was really cool.
Cool. So let's see. There's a Stephen Dietz play called This Random World.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can...
Well, I mean, one of the things that struck me as like a thread through all of the plays this year was they were all about death.
Yeah.
Now, granted, most drama deals with death, but all of these plays were really about death.
Yeah. All right.
Which, you know, can be good or can be bad. I think, they all explored it in different ways. The Stephen Dietz play you just mentioned, I thought it was a super well-made play.
Yeah.
It was like just a very neat, tidy, tied up play about misconnections in life. It mm-hmm. follows these set of characters who all are linked to each other in different ways, but don't know they're linked to each other. And there's a lot of missed connections. It starts with a adult siblings, brother and sister, whose mother is aging and they're not in very good touch with her. And then the mother has, they think that she's in at home and like not doing anything, but she's really traveling and not telling her kids because they'd worry about her. And she has an aide who has a sister who like has never traveled. And then one of the siblings has like an ex-girl from her high school that he misses mm-hmm. who's dating this other guy. And that other guy ends up meeting his sister on this trip to like Nepal, I think. And it's all of these weird misconnections. And it's like a beautiful meditation on life's funny nuances.
Right.
But I don't know if it expounded much beyond that.
Right.
No, but it's still, as Susie said, a really well-constructed piece. Mm-hmm. And Meredith McDonagh's staging was pretty fascinating in the respect that it's already a very busy play with all of these interwoven stories. Right. And she embellished it with using some of their either the Apprentice Company or the Acting Company in general to smooth the transitions. So going from scene to scene, they'd come through with suitcases.
Yeah, that's true. She did a really nice job. It almost felt really cinematic.
It did.
I mean, it was staged and they're in the round space.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I forget which one that's called. And so there was tons of transitions, but she had all the apprentices who usually move the sets for mm-hmm. all the shows kind of dress in costume for each transition. So if they're in an airport, like you transition with like apprentices pulling suitcases and they'd be dressed as airport passengers. And
so I see that Meredith also directed The Coffee Break by Tasha Gordon-Solman. I don't know if we want to go through every play individually or if you want to talk about the ones that you...
That was one of the one acts.
Right? Oh, a one act. Was it? Okay.
Yeah, that was... There's like three one acts. From the apprentices,
the 10
ministers. They're kind of, I mean, they're cool. I actually didn't catch them this year, I have to admit.
Okay.
So, but I don't know. What were some of the standouts for you, Russ? What were ones you like? My favorite was Peter Pan.
It was for me, too. I had great admiration for what This Random World was accomplishing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just the way it was bringing all those stories together. And Meredith's staging, I thought that was really, really great too.
I mean, the play that everyone at the festival was really talking about was Hansel Young's Cardboard Piano.
Okay.
Directed by Lee Silverman. I thought Lee's production was stunning. I mean, it was the first time I'd seen that place. There's this like upstairs, like kind of carpeted black boxy space that usually has minimal sets. The City Company thing was there last year or 2 years ago. It's about this play set in Africa, and it's about this white missionary's daughter who has a relationship with an African girl, and they fall in love. And I actually, to be honest, I didn't love the play itself that much, but everyone, a lot of people really did. It sparked a lot of discussion about it, and I thought the production was, and the way the space was used was really good. I don't know. What did you think of that one, Russ?
I had a similar response. Actually, a lot of people around me were criticizing the play as
really?
Well.
Everyone around me was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And I was like,
that's so
really? I find this play kind of implausible, but yeah. I'm glad you liked it.
Susie and I were there on different weekends, and I was there with mostly dramaturgs and literary managers, and Susie was there with other critics.
Tough crowds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I shouldn't even say this because I'm sure it did have a dramaturg, but there was a lot of things where I was like, you know, fact check that.
Yeah.
Right.
But the production, it was told a really important story, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely moved a lot of people. And, you know, Hansel's such an interesting young new playwright that's really on the rise right now and is worth paying attention to.
She was the most listed on the Kilroys last year. I think Carbo Piano was
might
one,
be
of,
one
the
of them. And I thought Lee's production was just gorgeous use of that space. But that was a really buzzy play at the festival this year.
Definitely. There were three roll callers in the festival, I think, representative
Martin
playwrights.
Mayock. Right?
Yep.
Martina G. Wasn't G.A.?
G.A. In Wondrous Strange. Yeah.
And Hansel.
That's right. Yes.
Anyone else? I mean, was Laura Jackman's play worth, was interesting?
You know what?
She's a writer whose name I've seen a lot and a Facebook friend, but I don't
remember.
I thought that it was a really great topic.
Yes.
It deals with postpartum depression.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I felt like it didn't go into it as much as it could have gone into it. It kind of went into it at a surface level. I also felt like the supporting characters were so much more interesting to me than the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I loved this actress who played this, I forget what her name is, but she played the assistant trainee manager of this
management
trainee. She's from Chicago. I looked into her. She was so great.
Yeah.
And she, it's set in this like long stay hotel, and this woman has come to like do some sales calls. She sells like, oh gosh, what's the name? I just lost it. Ultrasound machines. Ultrasound machines.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought the two characters who worked at the hotel were such interesting characters. I just wanted to see a play about them.
Right. Okay. I guess the only other major one was the Brendan Pelsu's Wellesley Girl, which was set in the future.
Ugh.
Not so good.
It was kind of,
we could edit this out if you want.
It was a post-apocalyptic, it was a post-apocalyptic play. And
no,
you know what? I felt like, you know, it was an interesting topic to explore.
Right.
It was very topical. There were lots of ties to like the Flint water crisis and like the Trump election and like all of that. But it also repeated itself so much.
Doesn't sound like there was a lot of really super form breaking. It sounded like a pretty well made plays this time. If you generalize, right?
I mean, I think the only one that I would say was form breaking, and it wasn't even form breaking, is Peter Pan.
Right.
Yes.
And you said that a big part of it felt like a very much a well made Richard Nelson kind of play.
Oh, the second act is pure Richard Nelson.
Right. Interesting.
I don't know. I have to say, I mean, I feel bad saying this on the record. I loved the Sarah Rule play, and I got something out of all the plays, but it wasn't my favorite festival.
Yeah. I have not been. I've only been a few times, my experience has always been kind of a "be careful what you wish for" kind of thing about new plays. We always want new plays, but you know, a festival of all new plays that have never. I mean, they've had developmental productions sometimes, or they've been in development, and they're all new. They're all brand new. It's a lot of new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there was something to really love about all of them. I will say that.
Yeah.
And I definitely I was very moved by This Random World. I was very moved by. I was moved by Residence. It's an important topic to explore on stage, but I don't know. It's hard to sustain a new play festival. I mean, people don't want to produce these new works in full because they are really new, which is why I feel bad saying I didn't love all of them. But it is really important that these works get these productions. And I think there's been a lot of talk about these shows getting reviewed by critics in New York and their future lives and all that jazz. But
I mean, I think it's gone through phases where it's had three artistic directors, I believe, John Jory and Mark Masterson and now Les Waters. And it's gone through phases where it was seen as a feeder for big New York plays and the big most produced plays and not, and as a place to try things out. I do think, you know, you look at the roster of talent, it's people, it ranges from people who are pretty well established, like Sarah Rule, to those who are up and coming.
Like
Hansel.
And like, what's his name, who wrote Wellesley Girl? I'd never even
Brendan
heard of him.
Brendan Pelsu?
I mean, what I will say
Brendan,
is that what I will say is that it does seem to like encompass a lot more than just the New York pipeline, for better and worse. I think a lot of people would love to see, you know, who get their play, and I would love to see more New York productions. Yeah. But, you know, it's not a place where you just go, oh, these are all next year's Playwrights Horizons plays.
Oh, no, not at all. Right. And so, I mean, something that is different, though, it's not an open submission process for Humana. It's an agent submission.
Right.
But like something like The O'Neill, which is not a full production, it's readings. That's an open submission. So it's a different criteria in that way.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a really important fixture of the American theater, and I think Rob's right. It's not just feeding plays to New York. It really is.
Here's one question I have for you. Last year, the Thomas Merton play, The Glory of the World, that and also The Apprentice play were both had a Kentucky base to them, like some reason to be done there. Was that a thing? I know Les has talked about that he wanted to make a Kentucky, you know, plays with a Louisville or Kentucky theme to them.
Yeah, he and I talked about that too. I spoke with him for my piece,
right?
And he brought up that factor, the way he's had a bluegrass play in the past. This time it came through in little bits and pieces, such as bringing in those local high school bands to come play in for Peter Pan. So it's there, but it's not always as on the nose as let's do a play about Kentucky.
I think one thing people felt about, and I think Les talked about this, maybe he talked about it with you, is that because of his background at the Joint Stock Company, whether it would only be plays that are made in the old fashioned, there's a playwright, there's a director, like it's this role, or whether there'd be more devised work. I know City's been a resident there. I know last year, the Pig Iron brought in their shows. I don't know if they developed them there, but they're people who make things in a different way than just playwright, director.
Yeah, I've noticed that in past festivals too, and I didn't see that this year.
This is more just plays.
This was more
just plays.
Which I think is appropriate for the 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
This is what their bread and butter is, and you know, they do it really well.
That's true.
And I like the idea of Louisville that makes so many things.
Right.
Also to make these new plays at Actors Theater. Cause it's cool on Main Street there. You walk back and forth and there are all kinds of places where things are made, including the Louisville Slugger Factory.
Oh, yes.
Where I peeked in.
Was Hillbilly Tea not there anymore?
It's not. It went out of business.
That's so terrible.
Sad.
But there's no other places. There's other places to eat and drink.
Indeed.
I think the press reception is at the BBC this year, the Brewing Company. What was the B before Brewing Company?
Bourbon?
No. No, I don't know. There's a local brewing company next. Local brewing company next Bordeaux. To the theater that has very nice local brews.
Great. Well, that sounds like fun. I'm gonna briefly just chat
it's
about
Bluegrass Brewing Company.
Bluegrass Brewing Company.
Of course. I'll just talk briefly about The Ground on Which I Stand was a 1996 speech that August Wilson gave at the TCG conference, which at the time was biennial, wasn't every year. It was at Princeton for a lot of the years. So it was at the MacArthur Theater Center. It was an incendiary speech and a very controversial and it led to a lot of, actually Teresa Eyring, our fearless leader from TCG was there, and she was at that conference at the time. She said it was one of her first conferences. She was running the Wilma Theater then, and the whole conference schedule had to sort of be rearranged in response to the speech. Everyone had to like do emergency breakout sessions to talk about the things he was bringing up. Now, the main focus of it was to stand for Black theaters and for Black theater artists, and to talk about how the statistic he gave was there were 66 Lort theaters, and one of them was a Black identified theater. And now the Lort theaters a little bit more than that, and there's no Black theaters in the Lort membership. Now, Lort is only one measure. There certainly are plenty of Black identified and theaters of color within the TCG umbrella. But that was part of the speech. He also, what's fascinating, that they did a reading with with James Williams, who's sort of an August Wilson original actor from Penumbra, directed and performed with five students. Princeton doesn't have a theater school, but they were theater English students and high school students who read the speech as a piece of theater at music stands. And it was striking to hear it again. What was amazing how There were a lot of things it didn't cover, and people talked about that in the talk about, but how much it did cover. He took on critics, subscription audiences, institutional theaters, funding, business model, the aesthetics. It was kind of like, I'm going to say everything I have to say about theater. And of course, from his point of view, which was about black theater, the black arts movement of the 60s, which influenced him. And then they had a fascinating couple of panels after that, to talk about the legacy of that speech and what it means going forward. How much has changed and how much hasn't changed. I would just say briefly, I'm going to write about this in my piece. Brandon Jacob Jenkins was on the second panel. And near the end of it, Vivian Banesh from Playmakers mentioned Hamilton because all these issues of colorblind, color conscious casting. And Brandon sort of joked and said, I was just waiting for someone to say, I was timing to see who was bringing up Hamilton first. But at that moment, Hamilton had just won the Pulitzer and Brandon, Jacob Jenkins, had just been named as a finalist. And he didn't find out till he walked off the stage and looked at his phone. So, I mean, that's just to say one thing about, and Emily Mann said this too. She was the artistic director of McCarter at the time, and still, that the plays she's most excited about are by women and people of color. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can point to some areas of progress, but there are artists of color working in theater more than before. And Mary McClinton, director, said there are more black playwrights now probably working than at August's time. But can they get the resources they need? Can they produce work at culturally specific theaters or theaters of color? Can they get the directors? The career path is still, and the resources are still an issue. So it was a question of, was it glass half full, glass half empty? How far have we come? We'll look at that. We're going to be doing more coverage in the coming month and a half. The actual date of the speech was June 26, 1996. So, that's around the time of our conference in D.C. So we're going to have a package of coverage taking us back to that controversial speech, the aftermath of it. There was a giant town hall that I think made the cover of the New York Times with Robert Brustein, who was one of the main targets.
Made the cover of the Times?
That's what someone told me.
Or the arts section.
I heard that it made the cover of the New York Times front page. I could be wrong.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think it was a big photo at the top, but anyway, it was a story that started on A1. I could be wrong. Maybe it was the cover of the Arts and Leisure. In any case, it was a big deal. It was a national story. And Robert Brustein, who was one of the main targets and interlocutors of Wilson, and one of Wilson's main critics as well. So they talked back and forth with Anna DeVersmith moderating. I wish there was audio of that. I actually think there is audio. NPR recorded it. In any case, we will move now to our interview, Russ's interview, with Louis Douthat. Do you want to say a few words before we go into it, or is it all self-explanatory?
I think you will enjoy.
All right, good.
Hi there, this is Russ Demmon, production editor of American Theater Magazine. I am joined today by Louis Douthat, who is director of literary development and dramaturgy at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, as well as director of Play On, a new commissioning program from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, in which they are having playwrights and dramaturgs create contemporary translations of plays by William Shakespeare. And so we're very excited to chat about that project today, as well as Shakespeare 400, the 400th anniversary of William Shakespeare's death. So to start off, Louis, could you tell us a little bit about how the Play On project originated?
I'd love to. First of all, thanks so much, Russ, for inviting me to talk about the project, and especially in this really auspicious week, approaching the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. And traditionally when we support his, celebrate his birthday too, it's a big week in Shakespeare land, for those of us steeped in it. So how this all came about was one of those innocent moments, which one would say upon reflection, a long-standing OSF patron named Dave Hitz, approached Bill about, wanting to, commission a translation of Shakespeare into contemporary English. American English.
And we're referring to Bill Rausch, artistic director of the Oregon
Correct.
Shakespeare Festival.
And at the time, and so Bill said, And I know Bill enough to know that hmm means yes. And so what we end up doing is asking that funder if he would support five commissions in a range from what we were calling literal translation at the time, which is what we thought Dave had in mind, to something adaptation. At the time, we were doing something called The Very Merry Wives of Windsor, Iowa by Allison Carey. And we have great interest in adaptations of Shakespeare. A lot of people have interest in those, and Bill in particular did. So he said, yes, Dave. And so we got this, the money to, very generous, to both commission and develop these plays. And I thought, I'm going to do this literal one first, because I didn't think it would really work. I didn't really know what he had in mind. I didn't really understand what he was asking for. And so then I approached Kenneth Cavender, who's a translator of Greek tragedies, and I said, treat it like a show me. Just treat it like a translation. And after his initial, like, this could be a career-ender thing to me, and then I said yes to me too, and then I said, we're too old, it's okay. And he said, yes, you're right. So then he did. He looked at it, you know, source language to target language, as if it were a translation. And we learned a lot about how the language works and how this might be possible. And he did a lot of tests like soliloquies, comic scenes, big group scenes, prose, poetry, blank verse. I mean, it was kind of a beautiful, different genres, Timon, All's Well, Much Ado About Nothing. So we went through different kinds of plays just to see if one, I don't know, took to it better. And along, after all of that exploration, we decided that he should do Timon of Athens. And he took it on, and he did a terrific job. And his friend Jeffrey Sherman, who's the artistic director at Alabama, produced it. Tony Cochran was Timon in that production, and I went to see it, and I thought, oh, my God, there's something here. So with the other four, I had commissioned Much Ado About Nothing with Ranjit Bolt to test comedy. And I was going for translators, right? Doug Langworthy, who also translates as German, right? So I asked him to do a history. Because I thought, well, let's just see what translators do with this. And mm-hmm. then along the way, also commissioned the Kew brothers to do a Two Gentlemen of Verona adaptation and another. We're still working on the fifth. Out of that original kind of pilot program, which we didn't know was a pilot program at the time. So on the way back from Montgomery, I thought, oh, my God, there's something to this literal translation, you know, and I thought, I don't exactly know, but there's something really fun about this. The dramaturg in me thought this was like a major geeky exercise, which was really fun. And so I was about to ask Dave for five more, because I thought, this is fun, let's just do five more. And then I thought, it's not exactly what my job is. And it kept falling off of the plate. Like, oh, yeah, right. There's the community. Oh, right. The translation thing. Oh, right. You know, and while we're doing so many other things at Oregon, so many wonderful things. And I got the idea to, and I knew I was the bottleneck, right? As a dramaturg, I was the bottleneck. I just couldn't get to all these, right? I just couldn't do all that work. Mm-hmm. As much fun as it is, I just couldn't do it. Even I had to admit I couldn't do it. And so I got the idea to attach a dramaturg to each one of the projects. And once that happened, the whole thing just opened up in front of me, and I said, I'm just going to go do them all. And I decided to do them all at once because I didn't want to be 82 trying to find somebody to do Edward III. And I thought, we'll just do it all, spread it all out. And so I went back to the funder, and I said, how about it? Could we do all 30? It was 37 at the time. I could tell you why it creeped up to 39. But dramaturg, blah, 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 and here's how much it was going to cost. And he said, okay. I mean, it was kind of like that. And I was like, oh, my God, now – we've got all these things to do. And so from there, created a major budget to support this. So there's a reading. There's a four-day workshop. I've got an assistant, which I'm grateful for. And there's money for social media. I didn't even know what this meant. I said social media. I put in some money. I didn't even know what it meant. And it was like, yeah, put a lot of money in that. And to cover lots of costs and costs, including a convening that we'll do in September. We'll try to bring 12 teams together and just launch the thing. So that's how it just sort of happened like that.
Very good.
One thing led to another.
And since you mentioned it, how did the number creep up to 39?
Yeah. Well, it was 37 because I was determined that it'd be 51% women and 51% writers of color. I would not take the assignment without this. This spoke to our commitment to EDI work at OSF. It speaks to my own personal and political stance.
And
I also wanted to...
EDI is familiar to a lot of people.
Equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Exactly.
It also spoke to my political interests, and I just thought I didn't want to be precious about this, really, because good God, people, we are in a tremendous moment in American playwriting. I think it's a renaissance. I think there are just so many great writers out there. I could have cast this three times over without thinking about it. And so I thought, partly to make it 3 years, it was just, there was nothing precious about it. It's like, oh, the last three, you know, it would start to get, you know, like, who would get it? It's like, oh, just. So there was something great about making an arbitrary prescriptive model. Do you know? I just had columns and I just filled them in until it was covered up. And it's an amazing group of artists who said yes to me. I was very moved by that, too. And so it came 37 because I wanted 51%. I wanted to legitimately say 51%, so I needed an odd number, right? And then Kenneth Cavender, sweet Kenneth, who had said no, he didn't want to do another one, came back to me and said, I want to do another one. And I went, oh, no, that's 38. So then I went back to the funder. I said, we have to do 39 because I want 51%. And that's how Two Noble Kinsmen came in. It was Two Noble Kinsmen. And I said, well, I'll throw that in there because I need an odd number so I can legitimately say 51%.
Right. And what was 38?
I think it was Edward III. I don't know which order it was. It was just all of a sudden when he came in wanting to do The Tempest, he was tipping the scale. And I was like, okay, I got to add another one. So that's how that happened.
And in addition to the criteria of 51% women and people of color, how did you select the playwrights and dramaturgs to be involved?
The dramaturgs were all selected by the playwrights. I mean, I had some ideas, this has been a long process of de-prescriptivizing because I had a lot of ideas about what this was going to be. Everybody was going to use the Folger Library editions or everybody was going to do certain things and everybody was going to have a Shakespeare dramaturg and everybody was going to be a translator of, well, I mean, I had to keep peeling away from my own prescriptive, like, way to order this. And so at first, so that's how that kind of, all of that happened was like, yes, it's great to have Kenneth and Ranjit and Doug and Lise Theron and a bunch of other translators, but it was also really great to open it up to playwrights and open it up to a couple of directors snuck in just for fun, just to see what they would think of it and what they would do with things. And also I wanted early career, mid-career, late career, you know, writers. But this speaks a lot about who I am in terms of where I am in my theater life. As a second-generation feminist means I'm a woman of a certain age, I knew certain playwrights. There were a lot of playwrights I didn't know. And I kept going to the well of playwrights I did know. And I thought, well, that was great. And there's been fewer joys in my career than giving money to friends for this really weird assignment. That kind of has no consequences other than the controversy outside of it. But it's an assignment, right? And I thought, yes, this is really fun, but there was only a certain amount of writers that I knew, you know, well. And I wanted to know the writers because I knew it was going to be controversial, and I thought they had to know that I would back them up. But that prescription went by the wayside, too. But I said, you have to get out of your comfort zone, and you have to reach out across many, many lines. And that has been an amazing joy, to do that. And there's still, I think there's one writer we're meeting today who I still don't know. I don't know Hansel Jung. I've never met her. And I'm looking forward to having lunch with her today. And so it was a great combination of people I knew really, really, really well and people I didn't know at all and sort of a smattering of all of that. And that seemed like part of the project too, to sort of spread it out like that.
Great. And where are we in the trajectory of the project? How much has been written? How much has been produced at various places?
Right. They are to deliver a first draft by October 31st, 2016. I assume there's going to be a lot of all-nighters pulled, is my guess, right? Because every one of these writers are incredibly busy, as playwrights are now. You know, they just are not waiting around for the phone to ring. You know, you have to have a couple of assignments just to kind of keep yourself in it, right? So one of the criteria, the only criteria, when I called each of the playwrights to say, tell me honestly, can you do this in a year? So it was like last July or August when I was talking, to playwrights, 15. I said, tell me honestly, can you do a first draft by October 2016? You know, and because if you can't, then I'm going to move on. And there are a couple exceptions of people I knew that they couldn't anyway, but I wanted them. So again, the prescriptive person had to like keep chipping away, which was really awesome exercise. That said, we've been kind of bugging them periodically, like, how's it going? You know, the reason to have a dramaturg, there were many reasons to have a dramaturg, but one was to be the bugger. You know, to sort of say, hey, could you just periodically see how your playwright's doing kind of thing and how's it going? And, you know, it's not that they're complex in a beautiful deep dive kind of way, like through language, but it's not like you're doing character, you're not doing plot, you're not doing, all of that has to stay the same. Then you're not to fix any of that. You're not cutting it. You're not editing it. It's 1600. You're sort of staying on point. I'm not asking you to solve things that people still don't know what they mean 400 years later, but you might come up with an interesting idea about it, and that is already proven true with some of the ones that we've heard in development as well as have seen produced. So I would say probably 8 of them are actively in process. There'll be a whole bunch of flurry this summer when people are off their academic, you know, timeline or in between gigs and, you know, like working at a theater or something, right? So I expect a lot of activity this summer and then a little, like I said, a big flare. There'll be a big flurry in September and October. Just to have the first draft due. I said, look, just fling something at me. I'm not going to know that much different. And then in 2017, we expect a lot of readings and workshops and then 18 sort of polish up and then it ends December 2018. And again, it was also a way to preciousize it because what you might do 10 years from now with the language of this play, I suspect would be different, right? So it's just like, what's your instinct right now about it? You know, and I asked for 2 drafts, kind of like 2 serves in tennis. It's like, yeah, throw one out there. Let's hear it. And then you go, oh, here's what it really is. And then clean it up and hand it to me. Like the base coat. I'm just asking for base coats. I mean, when it goes into performance, they will be adapted. There's no doubt about it. They'll be cut. You have to cut part of that fourth act of time, and I don't care what anybody says. You may put it in a different time period, right? Because that's what we do. And so that would have to be right? We make those adaptations anyway. You may do an interesting doubling scheme. You may change gender, blah, blah. All that is legitimate, you know, right? That's not what I'm asking anybody to do at the moment. Just sort of, you think about it like base coat. And so it's supposed to be 3 years. We'll see. I think actually we could do it. It should be exciting.
And of the examples that you've seen so far, how much variety are you noticing in the different approaches?
Well, I'll say this. In 2009, I ran a series at OSF for company members, and it was out of my own interest, which is that we, once a week, we started with 2 Gentlemen of Verona in January and ended with 2 Noble Kinsmen in the end of October, and every week we tackled a new Shakespeare play in somewhat chronological order. I think it was according to Marjorie Garber's book. So it was a kind of a, like, I'm not going to argue about this. Let's just follow this. And the fascinating thing there are many fascinating things that came out of it, and perhaps I should have taken better notes so we wouldn't have had to do this project. But every one of these plays is different. I know that they've been put in 3 categories in a book in 1623, but they are all different, right? And that's partly why I wanted different writers, you know, to tackle them and see what happens through their filter, walking with Shakespeare, what does that, how's that sound, or how's that feel, or how does your ear with contemporary modern English work with this? And so the two that I've seen produced are the late romances, right? So it's Tempest and Pericles. So there's a similarity to, I mean, sorry, Timon. And now this Tempest is, we just did this last week, and Pericles. I mean, there's a little bit of a similarity between the Tempest and the, and Pericles, obviously, although, the journey adventure story of Pericles allows for a lot of, leeway, I think, in terms of, poetic, intervention. And it's less well known. You know, as the plays that are more well known start to come out, it'll be interesting to hear how people respond to that. And the Timon is a really tough piece, you know, in my understanding. It was never produced in Shakespeare's lifetime. So I think even he thought maybe it was a little too dark for public consumption. It's a dark play. It starts from place and it just plummets and goes down. You know, just really is kind of a straight shot. And I thought, wow, something really bad happened in the mid 1600s because that was a tough period, Timon. Not trying to read too much of biography into these plays, but sometimes you can't help it. But sort of wonder like what was in somebody's mind, you know, as they were writing something. And it has that sort of dual authorial, provenance to it that we think, you know, I know George Wilkins said something with Pericles, but Middleton had a little bit to do with, Timon, did he write 2X? Okay. You can kind of tell the difference in a way, or at least we think we can. You know, it's like, oh, that must be Shakespeare. And generally we let Shakespeare have all the good lines and Middleton has all the bad lines. And I think that's a little unfair, but, I get it, right? So, even within the Timon, there's sort of a shift. And in the Pericles, there's a shift. I mean, those first couple acts, you're like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, I think Ellen would say this, Ellen McLaughlin, that all of a sudden you just are in a different stream. Whether that's because it's Shakespeare, most likely, the textual evidence is most likely. Or there's a whole trajectory of character from being two-dimensional, immature, to being three-dimensional, mature, right? Which is also a dramatic action of a character. Mm-hmm. Possible. But the language changes and she'd say, oh, it got so much easier. Now, whether it's because she was a little used to doing it too by that, you know, like in a translation kind of way. I don't know. But I find that kind of fascinating. So they are different because the plays are different so far. And the writers have had, although both of those, Kenneth and Ellen, have had a fair amount of Greek translating history, which I find kind of fascinating that they have that similarity. But they both have very muscular approach. Their language is very, very striking and deeply modern in that way, I think. So I don't know if they would have more similarities than not. I can't kind of remember Timon too terribly much. And, you know, the Pericles is just fresher. And obviously Tempest, which I just heard yesterday, is really fresh in my mind.
Mm. And the word adaptation is coming up, and of course some of the writers involved identify as playwrights, other known primarily as translators. Could you talk about the decision to call it a translation project?
Yeah, translation is a deliberate choice, even though we knew it would be controversial. I mean, we tried every which way to come up with a different word, transdaptation, you know, transliteration. Kenneth calls them transcriptions. Transpositions. I was like, well, if you transpose, it's still note by note, right? It's the gesture I'm interested in, not the literal word by word. That's the first definition that we go to when we think of translation. And I appreciate that. But what I really am going for is translation as a rigorous investigation. And then translation as carrying forward. What is the most exciting thing so far about this piece of me, the discovery for me, is that, as I said, it was a new play. So intellectually, I said they were new plays, but I have experienced them as new plays in this way, that for audiences and for the actors, because the lines have been changed enough, that they enter it as if it's a new play, like it was 400 years ago. And I find that translation of experience to be a worthy exploration. That said, I've given them very specific parameters because I have a very narrow definition of translation. They could translate every word if they wanted to because translation is in the title, how they interpret it. I don't want them to, but they could. I have a very wide definition of adaptation, which is you cut one line in Shakespeare, you've adapted it. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's just the way I've kind of pit them against each other.
Mm. And you brought up the potential for controversy. Could you talk about the range of reactions that this project has elicited?
Well, I hope I have this date right, but I think it was 2010 that John McWhorter wrote an article in American Theatre Magazine. Is that right? About it's time to translate Shakespeare? It's something like that. So I'm not good with the dates. Anything you can look up, I don't hold on to. This is the beauty of Google. But Teresa told me at the time that it was the single most controversial article ever in American Theatre Magazine. So and I was like, oh, that's interesting. This was 4 years ago she told me this. So, or whenever it was. I said, huh, I guess this is going to be controversial. So I knew full well that people would be excited by this announcement. And so they have. I mean, some of it is about the fear that we are dumbing down the language, and that there's a lot of accusations about what American audiences can receive and not receive, which has been an interesting thing to sort of contemplate through. And that seems to be where most of the controversy lie is in the because all I'm looking at is language, right? Of when that would, you know, what that would do. So that's mostly what it's been, and it's been hard to explain that without having any examples that we're not dumbing down language, that their charge is heightened language. They have to have heightened language. And the more that people have heard examples, the more they understand that it has a rigor to it. It's not Shakespeare, but it's Shakespearean in its rigor, and I think that's kind of great.
Very good.
You have to hear it to hear that they are new plays. And if you have it in that frame, then I think that the notion that we are being honorable in commissioning performable companion pieces. We are not out to replace Shakespeare. But these are legitimate pieces in their own right. And there's something we learn about these plays that we didn't, that I didn't know before. And okay, I must have missed it. There's an interesting article just last week by Andrew Dixon that was published in the Wall Street Journal, who says, you know, around the world, Shakespeare has been translated into contemporary languages, and that people do seem to know Shakespeare in a more immediate way than sometimes we do. And I think that that's kind of interesting too. So a lot of the argument about Shakespeare, you are to reach toward language. My goal would be we're still leaning in. There are just moments that seem in the moment of hearing them that are a little easier to grasp. So you can go on and really hear the arias that have great emotion about betrayal or love or hatred. That's where I get tangled up, is in some moments of when we're explaining something about a philosophy or somebody wants to do something politically and why they're explaining, you know, explaining why they're doing it. So those are the moments I find more difficult to work through. And I find that if they are unpacked and made a little bit more in the moment, easier to grasp in a narrative, I tend to have more emotional reserve to really go in and lean in when the language has to be gnarly because you don't know what you're talking about. Actually, language becomes complicated when you don't know, right? And I want that still to be honored. So clarity is not for clarity's sake. I want clarity for character's sake.
Yes, and some of this did come up in a piece that Bill Rausch wrote for us that was online late last year, in which he reacts to some of the responses that the project has gotten, and it itself, the story itself, evoked a variety of comments for us. Now, Lou, you mentioned John McWhorter's argument for translating Shakespeare. I heard it last week, so I think that was the first time it aired. Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson did a whole episode on Shakespeare in honor of the 400th, and John McWhorter came on and mentioned the play on project and rehashed a bit of his argument for why it's so necessary. That episode also touched on the idea of original pronunciation, OP, which...
That's fun.
Yeah, and it's the idea of trying to retrace how Shakespeare's company would have pronounced the words to try to get the language to be as genuine as possible so that rhymes work, so that puns work.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like it's, in a way, the other end of the spectrum with the same intention as Play On, both trying to get the material to be as accessible as possible, one trying to reach back and attempting to recreate Shakespeare as it was, the other bring it closer to our contemporary English. So yeah. I'm wondering how you feel about those two different endeavors.
They're two endeavors along with a whole bunch of other endeavors.
Yes.
I mean, gee, we've been doing a lot of different things in Shakespeare, you know, to try to make it clear. I find this all very ironic. I love the OP exploration because it's going to get back to rhythm. And there are times when the rhythm of the Shakespeare is funny. And I actually don't know what they're saying, but I know it's funny. And I laugh at the end of the at the line. Do you know?
Yes.
Just because of the rhythm.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot about that. And I don't know whether we'll be able to capture that or not. You know, replicate that. You know, when you translate, there's going to be some loss, right? And there's going to be some gain, but there's going to be some loss.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate a lot the issue of sort of like the loss of the language itself, sort of the glory of it. And I get that. And I have a hard time sometimes understanding it in the moment of hearing it. You know, so that's really my point of entry. And I think that there is a lot to be said for hearing it in its, in the sort of archaeological digging of the OP, in terms of making things make sense in terms of a rhyme that may or may would have had some sense, you know, 400 years ago, right? That we just kind of lose today. But that's true of any historical document. Listen, try to translate comedy from 400 years ago. Oh, P.S., try and translate it from 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy does not transcend time.
Yes.
Because comedy is about our contemporary society right now. And it just, and yes, we do the same boneheady things we've done for a long, long, you know, I think we've always done them. But that the references used fall away. So I think we're always, probably always going to be able to have some entry into a tragedy, a loss of a child, right? Or the untimely death of a, or the loss of a fortune or something like that. We're always going to have that, whatever the social milieu that the play is set in. But the comedy, whew. So I love OP because it's kind of bringing back the notion that some of it was just oral and silly. And I think that there's a lot about sort of the joy of the sort of riffing. Sometimes we get a little precious about sort of literal meaning, right? That kind of clarity should take precedent. We're also in a much more, to me, a very literal time, just in terms of the way we receive language on stage. We want to receive it very literally. And I don't think that that was always true of these Shakespeare plays either, right? So I don't want it to be so clear on my end, if you're going to put me on one end and put OP on the other, that it just flattens everything out. There will be some flattening, but there'll also be an ease of entry. And I think that's a good trade-off. Mm. And I think that's probably true of OP. There's going to be sort of a delight of like, oh, I get to just be in the river of that. And that's a wonderful journey and way to receive dramatic language, I think, that we don't often.
So, coming back to OSF, could you talk about, how this project fits in with what's going on for, Shakespeare's 400th at the festival and for the 400th at large?
Well, I think that all of a sudden celebrating 39 plays seems to be like a really good, you know, announcing that seems to be a really good celebration of somebody's legacy, huh? I deliberately wanted the announcement between 2014, which was the 450th anniversary of his birth, versus 2016, the 400th anniversary of his death, because I thought, oh my God, you know, people are really going to think we've gone crazy in Oregon that we're announcing this what has proved to be controversial project. So I thought, oh, let's just sneak it into 2015. That said, I mean, we just spent 4 days with some terrific actors, and Jeffrey Sherman, who's artistic director at Alabama, who will be directing Kenneth's Tempest next year. I mean, it was 4 days of table work. We talked about the play. We talked about character motivation. It was awesome in ways that even at a Shakespeare festival, we don't find the time to spend. You know, and we will kind of catch up with it as you go along. But there's a shorthand and assumptions about Shakespeare, I think, sometimes. And we just stopped and said, no, we have no idea. As if this was a new play, what's really going on? And it was just unbelievably sublime, right? So I think in a funny way, we're actually celebrating Shakespeare the dramatist. Because I'm asking people to stop and really pay attention to sort of the entry. And in Shakespeare, it's 90% oral, right? That's what it's made of. So I'm asking us to look at that again and celebrate the dramatist. There was a Time magazine article, I don't know, recently about all the different ways that the plays have been used over 400 years. And I don't know if anyone saw this chart. It's very amusing to me how many different ways we've tried to keep telling these stories. Yes, the language is magnificent. Nobody's been more complex, probably, ever. But the man was also a tremendous storyteller. And I think the stories, even though people want to poo-poo the plots, I think that that's not fair to them. Because actually, dramatic action-wise, and the way he tells stories and how he weaves stories together to use the suspense, he uses comedy, he uses a different genre, different kinds of language to keep me interested, to weave a very, very complex and complete story about a society. I think very few people have been that successful to do that. And so to go back and really sort of be at the master's feet, which is what this exercise is really asking us to do, I think definitely celebrates Shakespeare the dramatist in a kind of beautiful way.
And in general, how is OSF commemorating the 400th?
Well, first of all, we're doing five Shakespeare's this year, right? So that was like, we snuck another one in. We had an excuse to sneak another one in, right? Which is always problematic, you know, there's so many things. We have so many ambitions and so many things we want to accomplish, at OSF, as well. But that was really important to us, have that many Shakespeare's in our season. And we have a lot of events throughout the year. So it's not, everything's not just going to be, I've been joking. Yes, there are 1200 cupcakes showing up, but, everything wasn't just going to be on April 23rd, you know, done. You know, it's like, how do you celebrate all year long and beyond? Which is what we do every day at OSF, really. So there's an event up in Portland that Play On will be participating in, where we're doing a little demonstration of, we read the Shakespeare scene and then we're going to read a scene from Pericles, Henry VI Part 1, and Shrew, which will be really fun. These little demos are very informative in that way. And we're doing some, Twelfth Night happens to be performed on the afternoon of April 23rd. So there's going to be a big singing happy birthday with the audience kind of event. And the education department's been doing a lot of video clips on campus about how Shakespeare has been important in one's life, from students, teachers, OSF employees, everybody. And stuff like that. Nothing like one big thing, but definitely fun stuff throughout the year.
Very good. Well, Louis, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Really grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
And we're back with a few recommendations and things to talk about. Russ, what do you have for us? What do you want to talk about? Oh, no? All right. Susie, why don't you take it up?
I'm going to stall for a second while I look at my Apple
I could
calendar.
Just, that's what I could do. I could tell you mine. I'll tell you mine. Mine is not a necessary recommendation. It could be if it's still running when this comes. Yeah, it's still running.
Oh, wait. I know what I can recommend.
At BAM, the Royal Shakespeare Company is doing, I think they call it King and Country, history plays.
Sold out till the end of time.
The three Henry, Henry IV, Part 1, Part 2, Henry V, and Richard II, which that's the first one, which I saw last night. I was kind of avoiding it, but then I didn't make time for it, basically. But then the reviews have been so rapturous that I made time to see Richard II. I'm seeing Henry IV Part 1 on Saturday. I just want it's a great cast. David Tennant is an amazing Richard II. I was familiar with a lot of the speeches because they're so famous, but I didn't really know the play. And it's kind of a not very active play. It's a lot of equivocation. But anyway, it was great. And I went with Jason Zinnemann, and during the performance, he sneezed loudly at a very, this time was excellent. It was right in the middle of a pause as Bolingbroke, played by Jasper Britton, great, great actor, was sentencing, or not really even sentencing, but condemning two of Richard II's lackeys to death. And he's chewing them out, and Jason sneezed at a volume which was, felt like it was part of the show, really. And it's just, we were fairly close to the stage, and Jasper Britton said, "Bless you," and kept going. And it got the biggest laugh of the night, but it didn't derail the play. He kept giving Jason dirty looks throughout the scene, and like as if he was going to put him in. And you know, us in the next moment, they came out with these guys' heads in bags, and we thought Jason just narrowly missed. I would just like to endorse actors, you know, using the moment, the momentary things that happen, and spontaneous, as some people say, I didn't know the British learned yes and, but,
you know, that reminds me of when I saw Mark Rylance do Richard III.
Oh, I'm sure.
And they had those seats on stage. Remember?
Yeah, yeah.
A woman passed out in the middle of his speech on stage.
Right.
And he went off stage to like check if she was okay, totally in character, like walked off, make sure the stage hand handled
imagine
it.
Imagine Mark Rylance doing that.
It was scary. Like the whole audience saw this woman pass out from her seat. She was sitting on stage. Like,
wow.
And just in
the
middle.
She fell.
She fell to the side chair. She was fine, I think. Mark Rylance totally went with it.
Richard III, he would have, you know, maybe poisoned her or something.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
I think there was a brief moment when he made a broken character when he was like, are you okay?
Right.
But it was a very theatrical moment.
Huh.
I completely forgot. I have so many things to endorse because I went to Chicago this weekend.
Ah, okay.
And I think my favorite of what I saw, and everyone has been talking about how it's so wonderful, is the new Tracy Letts play, A Steppenwolf. It's just really stunning and gorgeous.
Mary Page Marlowe.
It's running through May 31st. So if you're in Chicago or nearby, I really, really, really recommend seeing it. It's like a 21-person cast. There's six actors who play the main character at different stages of her life in a non-chronological story. There used to be a baby, but the baby got fired, so now it's a doll.
Oh, babies are hard to work with.
I know.
Let me tell you.
It's really beautiful. I mean, you don't often see a play that kind of remarks on the unremarkable. It's a little bit similar to Stephen Dietz's play in that way. It's just pretty much about this ordinary woman in an ordinary town who lived an ordinary life, and nothing really special happens to her.
Do we think it's going to come commercially to New York or nonprofit?
I've heard that someone has the New York rights, and I bet you can guess that someone if I say Anna D. Shapiro in the same sentence.
And Scott Rudin.
Yep.
Yes.
So I don't know. It doesn't really feel like a New York play, but it does feel like an epic. The curtain call, there was like 21 people, but it doesn't feel that big when you're seeing it.
It doesn't feel like a commercial play, you mean?
No.
I mean, it'll come to New York. I mean,
it'll probably come to New York.
Charles Isherwood loved it, so it will therefore.
I loved it. It was a great play. And but the thing that struck me is it feels so small on stage because it's a series of very tiny scenes.
Yeah.
But there's no doubling of actors.
I got you.
And so there's like, and even the main character's different actor in every scene. So
right.
And it's a huge
cast.
They
just add up and then, okay.
I heard the Steppenwolf paid for the production with that grant they got from that lottery winner who like kept giving.
Oh yeah, the guy who did Glory of the World. I forget his name. Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
Anyway,
interesting taste.
He also
financed that Roberto Bolaño 2666 at Goodman. Anyway,
yeah. And he financed some of the apprentice program at Actors Theatre of Louisville.
Great.
What do you have there, Russ?
I'm going to recommend Ironbound by Martina Mayock, who's a former roll caller of ours, right, in our roll call series of theater people.
Also on our cover
watch
last October, among
that's
many,
right,
many people.
Yep. Yeah. Also has a new play with the Women's Project Pipeline Festival that's going up this weekend.
Cool.
So Ironbound.
Ironbound, running through April 24th at Rattlestick Playwrights Theater. And it's a co-production between Rattlestick and Women's Project Theater. I think it's fascinating, partly because it's an immigrant story and we don't get tons of immigrant stories on stages. Mm-hmm. But what was really intriguing to me is that it is very much about the female voice, but but there's only one female performer out of four.
Right.
The way that works is pretty compelling to me, making it very much a female centered work while the gender balance is otherwise. So,
right.
Yeah. It's a good play about a really hard on her luck individual, in the U.S. and the various people she interacts with. It's a compelling piece.
And Marin Ireland is great.
Yes, she is.
As always.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I should put that on my list.
Closes this weekend.
I won't see it.
Oh, wow. It's already the 24th?
Yeah,
my goodness.
I can't believe it. So, this is good. Great to talk to you all. And let's see. I should mention that you should rate us on iTunes. Leave us a review. Links to the things we talked about are on the show page.
The show page. Slate's words.
Okay, sorry. On the post. On our post, right? That's our show page, right? All right. So
Deep is in the room and we're just talking to her.
Has been an engineer this time, and she's been in the room. But
we keep asking her questions and she can't talk.
Signaling to us what we should be doing and saying. But really, she's just a puppet master.
And we should like to thank our pod mom, Deep Tran.
Yeah. All right. I love it. I think our time is up. Stay tuned for next time.
See you at the theater.